This podcast is made possible by the generosity of supporting members. Please visit dharmaocean.org to learn more about becoming a supporting member. You are listening to the Dharma Ocean podcast. Today, we continue our exploration of the different stages of the meditative journey. Reggie says that stages do not mean accomplishment. Rather, they simply reflect how our experience of the totality deepens as the journey of meditation unfolds. This talk was given at the 2013 Winter Datun, a month-long retreat held at the Blazing Mountain Retreat Center in Crestone, Colorado.
So we're still kind of a little bit in the chute, entering the Datun. And one of the things I did want to do briefly before lunch is just talk to you about the way in which this whole journey is about the body. You know, discuss the five jhanas again, you know, the unfolding of the whole journey and how that works as a somatic deepening. Our tradition is an earth-based spirituality. And it makes it different from the rest of Buddhism. Earth-based spirituality means that the spirituality comes out of the earth. Earth-based means our body is the basis. Our smaller body, which is our human envelope, and the body of, you know, material reality, that it's out of that that the spirituality comes. So, just to discuss briefly, we have these two features, you know, of our person, which, of course, is very well known now over the last, you know, 40 or 50 years of neurobiological research. But people have known about this for, you know, 150 years. We have, really, it's often discussed as two kinds of awareness or even two brains, you know, which, I mean, none of the language is very precise. But we have our thinking mind, which processes something else. You know, our left brain, it's processing something else. There's no primary knowledge in the left brain. There's only conceptual knowledge. There's only arranging and rearranging concepts. The only direct knowledge that we have is our somatic awareness. And when I talk about the soma, or the body, that actually includes the awareness that's within our, you know, below the neck, which includes the very, very tremendous intelligence of the heart, the so-called second brain of the gut, and then every cell has its own kind of awareness, as you know from meditating with the body. So it includes that, but it also includes the right brain, which is where all the information of our primary knowledge of our body is processed and we come to awareness, and it becomes organized in images and you know, nonverbal understanding and so on. So a lot of spirituality is a left brain thing. It's basically conceptually driven. And conceptual means ego. You know, the ego is seated in the left brain. And the right brain is non-conceptual knowledge. Right brain includes the body, the gut, the heart, you know, all the knowledge of the cells, the brain stem. All of that, there is accessible knowledge. It's not conceptual knowledge, it's direct perception. And, you know, what we call the unconscious, is actually the awareness of the body. You know, Freud and Jung and Adler and a lot of the early folks talked about the unconscious all the time as being the determinant, really, in our behavior. But they didn't know where it was. And now we know it's the awareness of the body. So the body is the Buddha nature. There's a woman that I talk about quite a bit named Jill Bolte Taylor, who was a neurobiologist at Harvard and had a massive stroke in her left brain and completely knocked out her left brain, her thinking mind. And she talks about her experience of the body as really an illumination, you know, a huge breakthrough in her whole life. And her experience of her body was, without her thinking mind, was that the body had no boundaries. And she felt that her body was as extensive as the infinite universe itself. And she experienced this for days and days and days and days, and she's never really lost it. She still feels that way, although she's recovered a lot of her left brain function. She said she also felt a sense of there was no separation between her, you know, the infinity of her own awareness, which was her body. She realized the nature of her body was awareness, actually. And there was no separation within that body between her and the experience, not only of people, but of everything. And she also, you know, experienced a sense of such incredible liberation and joy that the thought of having to come back and return to thinking was the most horrible thing, you know, was a horrible prospect for her when she was here. And she identified, you know, she's not a Buddhist, not a spiritual practitioner at all, but she identified this as, she said, this is what the Buddha must have been talking about. And she was right. So what we're doing here, you know, her approach isn't really that functional. You know, that we should all go out and do strokes in the left brain. Because, first of all, we couldn't function, and also we wouldn't be helpful to other people. Our left brain is what gives us the way to be within human community and be human beings and be functional and survive in the world. So we do it a different way. And by the way, drugs are another way to access this experientially, but drugs don't change you, unfortunately. They may change you a little bit, but what we're looking for is something else, which is the fundamental redisposition of our state of being, meaning that the center of gravity for us becomes this mind that Jill Bolte is talking about, Jill Bolte Taylor, that we never lose sight of that we actually live with that sense of awareness. Meantime, we're functioning humans, we talk to each other, and we have presence within the world as a normal person. But at the same time, there is this sense of the endless nature of our own awareness, and that we're not separate from the universe at all. In fact, we are the universe. When you think of it abstractly, it sounds like a kind of romantic statement, but the great thing about her thing is she's been there, done that. And she's very critical of actually neurobiology, because she said these people looking from the outside, you know, her compeers, you know, her colleagues are looking from the outside. They don't really know what it's like to not have a left brain, but she does. And it gave her a whole different way of doing everything. So we, you know, we're developing the infinity of awareness of ourselves, that's actually who we are. We're developing a sense of the tremendous interconnection with other beings. And we are working with our left brain to dismantle, as I was saying yesterday, the fundamental traumas, unconscious traumas that limit the way we do things and the way we see things. So this unfolds in stages, and this deepening of the sense of what the body is. Now, it's very, very interesting for me to go back and read the early Chan teachers in China, which we're talking, you know, before Dogen, who was born in 1200. We're talking about people from about the 8th century to the beginning of the 13th century. These people talk about dropping our conventional notion of the body, that's what enlightenment is. It's not that you separate from the body, but you drop the limitations that you impose conceptually on your experience of the body, and you discover your own body as the Dharmakaya, the body of the Buddha. So they're saying exactly the same thing, which is so interesting for me. So in the ground dhyana, we do this meditating with the body work. What happens is we begin to awaken capacities in ourself through that body of work. And what happens neurobiologically is we begin to grow neurons that we didn't have before. And in particular, we begin to grow neurons that connect the awareness of the body with the left brain. In modern people, you know, there are certain mechanisms in the brain of more traditional, you know, indigenous people and meditators where the left brain is actually neurologically intimately connected with the awareness of the body. And the information of the body is freely available to the so-called ego. And therefore, the ego is constantly updating itself based on the direct experience. And even indigenous people have this problem of separation. And so that's what a lot of their ritual is about, reconnecting their social brain, their left brain, their ego brain, with a direct experience of reality that is, you know, the left brain is 1% of our awareness and the somatic awareness is 99%. The left brain is abstract knowledge. The 99% is direct knowledge. But in spite of that tremendous imbalance, the even indigenous people need to keep reconnecting through ritual. You know, that's what ritual is. It's reconnecting with the totality, with their Buddha nature, with the unbiased, objective, direct experience of reality itself. Modern people, because of the way we live, even the neurons that are naturally part of our system have largely atrophied. And that's why, you know, I meet many people in my teaching who have no awareness of their body and they don't even know what direct experience is. They often don't even know what it's like to experience something in a non-conceptual way. Interesting. I've had academic people, psychologists, tell me, well, there's no such thing as direct experience. Everything is mediated through this thinking mind. You can't have direct experience. I've actually had colleagues tell me that. And they have, you know, they have a lot of sort of ways of justifying it. So this is our modern situation. And if we are, all of us are more or less disconnected, but the more disconnected we are, the less possible it's going to be to inhabit this 100% of who we are. And so the meditating with the body teachings give people a way. And you know, you can't do them once. You have to do them many times, these 20 protocols. But over time, you begin to grow neurons linking up you could say, information systems. And over time, you change as a person. And meditating with the body people, it's fascinating to watch them, how they change. They're more embodied. They're more grounded. They're more earthy. They're more relaxed. And they're more willing to inhabit the person they actually are. And they're not so caught up with, you know, so caught up in ambition and thinking that they have no idea who they are. We call it the ground dhyana because until you show up in your body, you can't go anywhere. Nothing's going to happen. The interesting thing about the more you become aware of your body, the more you become aware of the natural world. And a lot of people who do meditating with the body, suddenly you find out that they're out in the desert somewhere, you know, in a tent, because they just want to experience that, or they've gone on retreat in the mountains, or, you know, they've taken up gardening. It's fascinating. It's a fascinating process. When we do the meditating with the body, the ground dhyana, you know, in Dharma Ocean, Caroline and I are satisfied if you either do the program or you go through the 20 CDs, you know, and we have some instructions about how to use them so you can, you know, gain some basic competence in the embodiment teachings. We're satisfied. People can move on, you know, to the Hinayana and take refuge and so on. But at the same time, you do these practices for your whole life. And when you do Shikantaza, you're doing meditating with the body, but you're doing it in a more subtle level and a more integrated way. But you never leave those teachings behind. And, you know, even after, like in my case, it's been 25 years that I've been working with this, I will still go back and do 10 points practice in certain situations. I will still go back and do the different kinds of breathing. When you do shikantaza, of course, you are doing about 6 of the meditating with the body practices in that one practice. But what I want to emphasize is, it's the ground jnana because it's always the ground. Then at a certain point, we have a little bit of a problem. Every one of the jnanas has a Trungpa Rinpoche called an overhang or a hangover. With meditating with the body, what happens is you get really comfortable, you become really easy. You're sitting, you feel uncomfortable, you lie down and breathe into your lower belly. You get a little tired, you sit back up and you start doing skull breathing. Then all of a sudden you feel like you're kind of disconnected, so you come back and you do your central channel. Now, the thing is, the good part is, you're really staying with your body, but the problematic part, not in the beginning, but later, there's no commitment to your experience at that point. Strangely enough, you're not committed, because every time things get really hot, you do a different practice to address it. You see what I'm getting at? So at a certain point, the question comes, well, what if I actually sit with my experience? Then what? And maybe my experience is actually, maybe it's really, really important for me to commit myself to see through whatever I'm going through. At that point, we begin to realize how much we're driven by impulse, even, as doing meditating with the body. And this is something, personally really became an issue for me. I began to realize that although, in a way, I felt very, very embodied, my life was still governed by impulse. Even the way I meditated was governed by impulse. And the Hinayana is, as I said yesterday, it's all about learning to sit through impulse. Maybe, I'm sitting up and I'm starting to feel really uptight, and so I decide I want to lie down and breathe into my lower belly. In the past, I would do that. Not me personally, but those of it, when we're doing meditating with the body. And we would find out the uptightness is actually, it's actually up there, it's not in the body. Very important discovery. But at a certain point, you wonder, what would happen if I sat through my desire to make myself comfortable? And that's what the Hinayana is all about. It's learning to not act on impulse, to give situations a little bit of room and see what happens. But as long as impulse is in the driver's seat, you can't really do it. So in the Hinayana, through the practice of shikantaza at a beginning level, because what we're doing here is beginning shikantaza style practice, what we're doing is we're learning to sit through a lot of situations. Now, I don't know if you noticed this today, but the first, we did sit for 45 minutes, and I was saying to Caroline, gee, that was a long time. I thought my clock broke or something. And unfortunately, my clock did break once, so of course, now every time it seems long, I get paranoid my clock is broken. But I'm guessing, because I wasn't, able to see, but I'd say about 3/4 of the way through, all of a sudden, something happened in the shrine room, and people woke up a little bit. We had been drifting and tired, and it was kind of foggy. And then all of a sudden, it was very subtle, this sort of very subtle kind of brightness came into the room. I don't know if some of you may have noticed that, but that's how it works. And you find out that by sitting through even fatigue, even tremendous fatigue, you find out how much of it's mentally created. Or anger is another really interesting one, or feeling really lonely or needy or frustrated or anything. You sit with it, and the great thing about the posture is you don't really have an outlet. You can't do anything. Even a while back, I noticed that when I started to feel anxious, I'd pick up the tea. And I thought, well, that's interesting. What would happen if I didn't pick up the tea? And shikantaza really gives, and even you move. That's the other thing. 10% of movement is legitimate and necessary, but 90% is because we're suddenly feeling anxious. And so we move a little bit, and somehow we recalibrate and we feel better. And shikantaza is such a blessing because you can't do that. You just sit there and you have to sit through it, and you do sit through it. And what you discover is how much of our mind states we actually ourselves create. And when I say every mind state is workable, I mean if you stick with your state of mind rather than medicate, for example, you're going to find the mind state is not a solid thing. You have it, you feel it, it's terrifying sometimes, but you sit with it, and the mind state has a journey. The mind state has its own life. And our job is to make room for that mind state to go through its birth, its life, and its death. So that's the Hinayana. And, you know, when we do Shikantaza in terms of the body, you know, we're incorporating a lot of the body work into it. And our experience of our body at the Hinayana level, we go through, gradually the body opens up. And I'm not going to, you know, try to say how it's going to be for everybody, but the experience of breathing into the lower belly, it makes a journey. There's some days when I feel like I cannot stand this. I can't stand it. It's too claustrophobic. I want to do something else. And on retreat, you know, I got to see this process. And then after a while, it was like, I never want to move again. My mind feels so at ease and so vast and so free. And the experience of my breath is so fresh and open and filled with energy. I never want to move again. I'm never going to move again. I'm going to stay here for the rest of my life. But then, of course, that changes too. So the Hinayana is not just about overcoming impulse. It's what happens when you do overcome impulse. And I would say, you know, Caroline's three stages that she mentioned really apply here. Number one is through the practice, everything begins to open up. Number two, a lot of things come up, and it's very important we don't judge them, let them be. Let the 10,000 things rest. And number three is, then we really begin to see who we really are. And we see we're not this small person. We're not this messed up person. As Nelson Mandela said, you know, many years ago, we are so vast and so powerful, and that's what scares us. It's not being too small, it's being too big. But then when we finally uncover that vastness and that power and that love, we know that's where I want to be.
To download more of Reggie's teachings, find out about upcoming retreats, and to explore a variety of audio listening guides to assist you on your spiritual journey, please visit dharmaocean.org. Music is by Jeff Beal and Nawang Ketchog from the album Tibet, Cry of the Snow Lion.